063938, excuse me, and related cases. BASF against Great American Assurance Company, et al. Mr. Hacker, I believe you're going to lead off.
Correct. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, John Hacker, Counsel for Appellant, Westchester Fire Insurance Company. The threshold question in this case, in this appeal, common to all three defendants, is whether the Synthroid complaints asserted claims seeking damages for, quote, advertising injury or personal injury. Those terms are, for our purposes, defined identically as, quote, injury arising out of the offenses of oral or written publication of material that slanders or libels a person or organization or disparages a person's or organization's goods, products, or services. Now, the question, of course, is not whether the Synthroid plaintiffs explicitly labeled their claims libel, slander, or defamation, but whether on the facts alleged in their complaints, the Synthroid complaints, quote, raised a potential for liability under one of the offenses listed in the policies. And that formulation of the doctrine comes from the Illinois Appellate Court's decision in the Lexmark case, but it's not an unusual formulation. It captures the basic rule. If the complaints did, the facts alleged did establish a potential for liability for a defamation offense, then, of course, there was a duty to defend, at least in theory, and my co-counsel will address reasons why even under those circumstances an excess insurer wouldn't have a duty. But at least in theory, there might be a duty to defend. But if not, if the complaints, no matter how read, could not possibly establish a potential liability for defamation, cannot be construed as, quote, tacitly stating claims, and that's from the Riso case, for libel, slander, or defamation, then there's no potential for liability, no potential for coverage, and no conceivable theoretical duty to defend. The Synthroid complaints we submit are quite clear. They raise no potential for liability for defamation because the Synthroid plaintiffs did not allege that they were defamed in any way whatsoever.
Didn't the claims arise out of defamatory activity?
They did not within the meaning of arise out of. That's certainly BASF's submission here, and it's what the district court held, that while the claims do arise, they concede, from antitrust and consumer fraud injuries from the overpayment, which are not advertising injury, not defamation offenses, the submission is they also arise indirectly from defamation because the antitrust and consumer fraud offenses were accomplished in part by the means of defaming persons or products other than the Synthroid plaintiffs. That, Your Honor, the problem with that, Your Honor, is it's a completely unprecedented and, we think, gross misconstruction of the concept of arising out of, which is a very common phrase as used in insurance policies. Literally, no court, not one anywhere, in Illinois or anywhere else, has ever adopted that construction of the phrase in this kind of context, except for the Knoll Court in the primary insurer litigation, which the court below simply cited. That was the only authority for the proposition. But it's not like the proposition's ever been never been litigated. It has. And courts everywhere have uniformly rejected it. The best case in Illinois for the proposition is the Diamond State case, which construes the identical, materially identical phrase on account of. In that case, there was coverage for claims on account of bodily injury. Again, identical sort of coverage construction. And in that case, the HVAC system injured a company's employees, had health problems, couldn't come into work, right? The company then sued and reduced the productivity of the company. The company then sued the HVAC maker for its economic losses caused, the company said, by the bodily injury of its employees. And then the HVAC company turned to its insurer and said, well, we want coverage because this claim is on account of the bodily injury. And the Diamond State Court said, no, this is a claim for economic losses, not for bodily injury. The fact that it bears some connection in its history, even a causal connection, to somebody else's bodily injury does not convert the claim being asserted against the insured into a claim for, in that case, bodily injury. The reasoning is identical here. These are claims for economic losses arising from antitrust offenses and consumer fraud. The fact that those antitrust offenses, consumer fraud offenses, can be traced back in their history to some causal connection to defamation to somebody else does not create any possibility whatsoever that the Synthroid plaintiffs could establish liability for defamation, and that's the covered type of offense. There are numerous other cases rejecting the proposition on even more identical facts and reasoning, if that's possible. There's the Rizzo case we cite in the First Circuit by Judge Boudin, a noted antitrust scholar, the QSP court case in Connecticut, which has a lengthy discussion of precisely this question of arising out of. There's a several-page analysis of that phrase and why it can't be construed as broadly as BASF submits in the district court below found. There's a Purdue-Frederick case from the New York Appellate Division, and there's three other Illinois cases that I don't need to elaborate but are cited in the brief, Crum and Forrester, Fremont, and Templeman, which reject the same sort of reasoning where you've got a claim that might be covered sort of in the background or history of the claim against somebody else, but the claim before the asserted against the insured is not one of the covered claims, and no court, again, either in Illinois or anywhere else, has held that that can count, includes arising out of.
How does the settlement of the Knoll case play into this?
Well, we don't think it plays into the advertising injury analysis I'm providing at all. The primary insurance case was determined, argued before this court, and settled on about 30 cents on the dollar. So you can draw whatever inference you want from that. But as a matter of law, on the issue I'm discussing now, we think it's beside the point. There simply isn't any decision, certainly no appellate decision. I mean, I guess it raises the possibility of an appellate decision on the point. And the reason is
there would have been.
Yes, there would have been, and we would like to think it would have been favorable, but that's
since
why cases,
I was on that panel.
That's why cases get settled. And we certainly invite you to think back to the analysis in that case, because on this point, it's true. The analysis is we think indistinguishable, and both courts were wrong for the same reason. Arising out of cannot be construed. All the courts that have analyzed it and rejected the argument advanced here have explained, or not all of them explained in the same way, but the QSP case and the Rizzo case probably the best, most careful explanations of it. There's really two related reasons why you can't simply unbind the chain of causation to make an endless but-for analysis as BASF submits. And let me emphasize briefly that they have not, and neither has the district court, submitted or proposed any limiting construction whatsoever. They just say it's but-for causation. If there's something in the past where there's a causal link, it therefore arises out of. And that can't be right for at least two reasons. First, it would open an insurance policy, the insurance policy, to claims literally unpredicted and unpredictable. This is a policy, like other policies, for, in this case, advertising injury and personal injury, not for antitrust injury and consumer fraud injury and other types of injuries that, that the actual complaint might be traced back to. And relatedly, not only is it unpredicted and unpredictable risks, it leads to insurance for uninsurable risks, including antitrust, consumer fraud, securities fraud, as the Rizzo case explains. Those are claims that, in absent very unusual circumstances, insurance companies don't offer, don't sell, and insureds can't buy insurance for. And to say that if we can trace it back to some act that might be a covered offense by somebody else, if they were to sue on those grounds, leads to just to insurance for just the kind of risks that were not supposed to be insured and were not insured in this case. And if the court has no further questions, I'll yield the balance of my time to Mr. Schenck for the moment.
Thank you, Mr. Hacker. And we'll hear now from Mr. Schenck.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, Todd Schenck on behalf of Appellant Federal Insurance Company. I would like to discuss two issues. First, the limited circumstances under which an excess insurer can have a duty to defend, and second, allocation. Even if we assume for the moment that the Synthroid litigation did allege advertising injury or personal injury, which it didn't, the excess insurers here still had no duty to defend. That duty to defend rested at all times with the primary insurers. The excess policies have two parts, coverage A and coverage B. Under coverage A, a duty to defend can arise if the applicable underlying insurance is exhausted by payment. The primary policies here were not exhausted until January 16, 2004, when BASF and the primary insurers settled the prior coverage litigation, and allegedly the primary insurers paid out their limits as part of that settlement. But the Synthroid litigation had been over for years by that point in time. There was nothing left for the excess insurers to defend. Now, BASF suggests that actually exhaustion took place years before, on October 30, 1997, when preliminary approval was given to the class action settlement of the Synthroid litigation, even though the primary insurers had paid nothing at that point. And BASF dubs this theory functional exhaustion. This functional exhaustion theory is contrary to admissions they've made below that the primary policies did in fact exhaust January 16, 2004. And contrary to its conduct in the primary insurer litigation, where it sought and obtained from the primary insurers a judgment for all defense costs, including all of the defense costs after preliminary approval of the class action settlement. Now, BASF suggests its prior admissions and prior litigation conduct are no impediment to its recovery of defense costs here. And that's because it asserts there's some difference between exhaustion of a primary policy for purposes of ending a primary insurer's duty to defend and exhaustion of a primary policy for purposes of beginning an excess insurer's duty to defend. They assert there's a difference, but they never tell us what it is. And that's because there is no difference. It's two sides of the same coin. A primary insurer's payment ends the primary insurer's duty to defend, and that same payment begins the excess insurer's duty to defend. BASF hypothesizes of this mysterious difference in the kinds of allocation in hopes of harmonizing its current position here with its prior position. BASF has not cited a single case from Illinois or anywhere else that has adopted a functional exhaustion theory of this kind, or that has even considered a functional exhaustion theory. BASF is asking this court to create new Illinois law, but functional exhaustion would be bad law. The duty to defend is significant. Unlike the duty to indemnify, it is uncapped. An insurer's obligation for defense costs is unlimited and can end only once it has exhausted its indemnity obligation by making a payment. Excess insurers charge relatively modest premiums under the reasonable assumption that they will have a duty to defend on only those rare occasions when the primary insurance is exhausted. Primary insurers charge comparatively large premiums to compensate for the significant burden of undertaking a duty to defend in all cases until they have exhausted their limits. As recently as yesterday, the Illinois Supreme Court has repeatedly emphasized, and the case yesterday was the Kojima Construction case, they have emphasized these differences between primary and excess insurance and cautioned courts to respect and uphold those differences. Functional exhaustion would wipe away those differences by prematurely moving the duty to defend from a primary insurer to an excess insurer before the primary insurer has made a payment and while its duty to defend is still in existence. For that reason, functional exhaustion cannot be the law of Illinois. The excess policies also have coverage B, which is a gap-filling coverage intended to drop down and provide primary coverage for some of the gaps that sometimes exist in primary insurance. But if we assume that the primary insurance applies, then there were no gaps for the excess insurance to fill, and thus there could be no coverage B duty to defend. The court below, however, concluded that even though the primary insurance applied in its estimation, there were still gaps that the excess insurers had to defend. Specifically, the court said the Synthroid plaintiffs made claims before they brought their lawsuits. And while the primary policies have a duty to defend only suits, the federal and Westchester excess policies have a duty to defend claims and suits. And thus, the district court held, federal and Westchester had a duty to defend those claims that fell outside the primary insurer's duty to defend. Now, the district court was just factually mistaken. The Synthroid consumers never made any claims before they filed their suits. They filed their suits within days, if not hours, of publication of the Wall Street Journal article exposing BASF's wrongful conduct. It's undisputed that they never made informal demands or claims before filing those lawsuits. Thus, BASF suggests third-party payers, the insurers, made claims before they filed their suits. Actually, all the third-party payers did was in response to the notice of the consumer class action settlement, file motions to intervene because they believed they were subrogated to the consumer's rights, having been the ones who paid, or more accurately, overpaid, for Synthroid. The motions to intervene are not claims, as that term is understood. They were part of the suits that were already in existence. They were filed before Judge Bucklow and heard by her as part of the MDL litigation. Under Illinois law, suit is defined as a proceeding in a court of law, which the motions to intervene surely were. In addition, third-party payers, in conjunction with their motions to intervene, not surprisingly, filed complaints in intervention. So there were complaints. Again, BASF is undone by its prior litigation position. If, in fact, the third-party payers made claims that were not covered by the primary insurance, BASF never would have sought and obtained a judgment against the primary insurers for the cost of responding to those motions to intervene. But it did. Simply put, even if the Synthroid litigation involved advertising injury or personal injury, that means that the excess insurers here had only a potential duty to indemnify under their follow form coverage A. They had no duty to defend under either coverage A or coverage B. The last issue I would like to discuss today is estoppel. District court precluded the excess insurers from allocating the Synthroid settlement between covered and uncovered claims and precluded them from asserting other coverage defenses. The estoppel doctrine only applies if there's a breach of the duty to defend. Here there was no duty to defend to be breached, so the estoppel doctrine does not apply. In any event, allocation in particular is not subject to the estoppel doctrine, as this court held in the Platinum case. There the court said an estopped insurer may, quote, raise the defense that the policy was not in effect when the injury occurred, or that the policy does not cover the type of damages sustained. This is exactly the analysis we sought to undertake in the so-called damages trial below, but we were precluded from doing so based upon the district court's application of the estoppel doctrine. BASF tells us that Platinum is a misstatement of Illinois law, but it doesn't tell us why that's so. And in any event, the estoppel doctrine should never be applied so broadly as to create coverage for losses that are clearly outside the scope of the insured risk. For example, losses that were incurred dozens of years before a policy incepted or dozens of years after a policy expired. An insurer should be allowed, even under estoppel, to enforce its policy period limits. Nor should estoppel force coverage for strangers to a policy, simply by virtue of the fact that those strangers to the policy had the fortuitous luck of being co-defendants with a named insured under the policy. But that's exactly the consequences of the district court's application of the estoppel doctrine below. We were forced to pay for insurance for losses years before and after our policies expired, for uninsurable risks, and for even the liability of BASF itself, who is a stranger to our policies. If there are no questions, I will relinquish the rest of my time to my co-counsel, Ms. Kohlross.
Thank you, Mr. Shane. We'll hear now from Ms. Kohlross.
May it please the court, counsel, Melinda Kohlross representing Great American. The district court below held that the insurers were all estopped from raising and pursuing any of their policy defenses based upon its erroneous determination that the excess carriers owed and breached their duty to defend. As Mr. Schenck has ably discussed with this court, there was no such duty owed by the excess carriers, and thus there was no breach. Accordingly, the excess insurers are entitled to rely on all of the coverage defenses set forth in their appellate briefs. Today, I would like to focus the court's attention on two of those coverage defenses. The first is late notice. Under Illinois law, a delay of even a few months may breach a policy's notice requirement as a matter of law, thereby defeating coverage. Here, the Great American policy required prompt notice of any occurrence or suit likely to involve the policy. The Westchester policy required notice as soon as practicable of any occurrence which could result in a claim under the policy. The federal policy required notice as soon as possible of any claim, occurrence, or suit which might involve not only the excess policy, but even the underlying primary policy, a very stringent notice requirement. BASF's failure to notify the excess insurers of the Synthroid lawsuits until June 23, 1997, some 14 months after the first Synthroid lawsuits were filed, fails to satisfy any of these notice requirements and is unreasonable as a matter of law. The facts before this court are undisputed. BASF delayed 14 months from the April 1996 publication of the Wall Street Journal article exposing BASF's misconduct and the lawsuits which began hours and days after that publication. During this 14-month delay period, more than 40 individual and class action lawsuits were filed against BASF. BASF both expected a flood of litigation, received the flood of litigation, and retained more than 20 law firms nationwide to defend this enormous litigation at a cost of more than $3.5 million. They engaged in months of settlement negotiations with the underlying Synthroid plaintiffs and were already in agreement to a nine-figure proposed settlement. In April 1997, a full 1 year after the beginning of the Synthroid litigation, they notified their primary insurers of the Synthroid lawsuits, but still failed to notify the excess carriers. In May 1997, they agreed with the underlying Synthroid plaintiffs regarding a proposed $9 million settlement and petitioned for an MDL consolidation on that basis, and yet still they failed to notify the excess carriers. It was not until June 23rd that the excess carriers were finally given notice. And although prejudice is not required in order for the insurers to prevail on their late notice defense, we submit that prejudice is indeed established in this case, as less than 30 days after the notice to the excess insurers, BASF actually executed a memorandum of understanding agreeing to the $101 million settlement that received preliminary approval from the district court approximately 2 months later. So at this point in time, the die was cast. They were looking at a $100 million plus settlement obligation, and we submit that that is prejudice to the excess insurers. Even recognizing prejudice is not required. 14-month delay under these circumstances with a very sophisticated commercial insured is unreasonable as a matter of law under Illinois law, including the Montgomery Ward case cited in our brief. Moving on to the second coverage defense, that of the prior publication exclusion. The prior publication exclusion found in each of the insurer's policy bars coverage assuming that BASF had established advertising injury or personal injury under the policy. It would still exclude coverage arising out of any oral or written publication of material whose first publication occurred before the inception of the policies. Here, the allegedly offending material was the defamation of Dr. Dong and her study and the alleged disparagement of competitors' products as not being bioequivalent to Synthroid and not being interchangeable with Synthroid. However, as detailed in our appellate briefs, such statements had been made well in advance of the inception of the excess policies. These statements regarding a lack of substitutability and interchangeability of Synthroid and critique of Dr. Dong and her study began in 1987, continued through 1988, 89, which is when the first excess policy incepted, and in fact the Great American policy didn't begin until 1992. Federal's policy didn't begin until 1993. There were literally years of these allegedly offending statements being made by BASF prior to the inception of the excess policies. Therefore, assuming they could even establish otherwise covered advertising or personal injury, it is barred here by application of the prior publication exclusion. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Colros. We'll hear now from Mr. Martin.
Good Good morning, Your Honors. Alan Martin for Appley BSF AG. As a starting point and a premise, we begin by looking at what Illinois law would do in this circumstance, in this instance, which, as Your Honor indicated earlier, was where we began the last time we were here. And Illinois law begins with a premise that the insurance companies are the masters of their policies. They control the drafting. They decide what is in the policy, and they also decide what is outside the policy. They're the ones who drafted the policies at issue here. With respect to the defense obligation that goes hand in hand with that, an insurance company has two options in the event a claim comes forward, and that is either to defend under a reservation of rights, making sure the policyholder is protected, or go into a court, promptly seek a declaratory judgment action, and have a court decide for it whether or not it ought to be providing that defense and protecting that policyholder, or whether its arguments against doing that have some validity and having a determination made up front. Neither of those two options took place here. The carriers here never defended under reservation of rights, and they didn't go into a court and ask for some guidance as to what ought to happen, notwithstanding the claim that they have some certainty here. At the end of the day, we find ourselves here 10 years later after this litigation took place, and what is it when you distill down that the insurers are saying? They're basically saying is the only way they could defend is if you had, from BSF, allegations that were a dead-on, down the center, middle of the target, bullseye on common law claims of defamation or disparagement. But that's not what their policies insure. They aren't limited to listing common law claims for disparagement or defamation. It's much broader than that if you look at it. And if you look at the Illinois law, and there's been no reference to the Valley Forge Swiderski case, recently decided within the last year by the Illinois Supreme Court. And in that instance, the two claims that were at issue were statutory claims, consumer fraud and the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. And the question was whether or not that could invoke, under the advertising energy, a parallel offense of invasion of privacy. There was no common law claim for invasion of privacy. And the Illinois Supreme Court said, looking at the allegations, following the rules, and we'll go through that standard of broad and liberal interpretation, the question is, are there any allegations of that kind of wrongful conduct here? And if so, those need to be defended. And you judge that by a layperson. You look at what the average person would look at it and understand that to mean. And notwithstanding that those were couched in a statutory framework, as was the case here with the consumer fraud case, the Illinois Supreme Court concluded that there was indeed a duty to defend, and not just by the primary insurer, but the excess insurer as well. Both had a duty to defend in that instance. Looking at a line of cases both from this court and the Illinois Supreme Court, you have cases such as Valley Forge v. Swiderski. You have Outboard Marine Corporation. You have Employers Insurance of Wausau. And then this court's decisions in Two's Funeral Home, Travelers Insurance Company v. Penda, Hearst Roche, and the Cincinnati Insurance v. Eastern Atlantic. And what do they say? They say, for example, with Outboard Marine and the Wausau case, Illinois has a strong public policy interest in making sure that policyholders are protected and defended at their time of crisis. How do we affect this? Because, you know, the insurers are the ones who draft these policies. You're not starting even-handed when you begin and there's a claim that rolls in. So it's uneven. So you have to put the finger a little bit on the scale to help the policyholder be put into a similar position vis-a-vis the insurance company when a claim rolls in. So what do we do under the duty to defend? The Illinois Supreme Court and this court's decision say the duty to defend is much broader than the duty to indemnify. You have to compare the allegations of the underlying complaints to the policy language, and they have to be construed liberally in favor of the insured. If there's any allegation of fact within or potentially within that gives rise to potential coverage, the insurer has to defend. Simple as that. And the complaint need not allege or use language affirmatively bringing claims within the scope of the policy. That's been recited repeatedly in Illinois Supreme Court decisions as well as the decisions of this court that are cited in our brief. It's not the legal label that is important. It's not how the particular plaintiff characterizes the claim, but it's what is the category of conduct that is being alleged. And when we talk about what were the decisions of Judge Castillo in the original Noel case, what were the decisions of Judge Derriagan in the case below, what were the decisions of Judge Conlin in the Del Monte case, where also disparagement was found, look at also the Illinois decision, Lexmark. They cite Lexmark. Well, that was Judge Wilson, Illinois Appellate Court. And what did he do in terms of analyzing whether there was disparagement sufficient to trigger the duty to defend? He's used as examples the Knoll case. That's what he uses as an example of the kinds of disparagement that would trigger a duty offense. He cited to Judge Castillo's other decisions in Winklevoss as well as Sun Electric to give examples of the kinds of allegations that, in fact, would trigger a duty to defend, because that's the kind of conduct that these policies cover. And it's the possibility of coverage, not the probability, that's determinative. Repeatedly, the courts talk about the threshold for triggering that to be very low. All doubts and ambiguities decide in favor of the policyholder. And in the final analysis, and this is in the Curtis Sheboygan decision and other cases, it's not an insurer's ability to try to characterize what it calls the dominant nature of a complaint or what they may decide or view as the core of the complaint. It is whether there is any allegation of wrongdoing that is potentially covered by the insurance policy. Here, I'd like to point one other thing out, and this comes from the outboard marine decision of the Illinois Supreme Court. The Illinois Supreme Court has said the CGL policy itself, the primary level, is the broadest type of coverage you can get to cover a wide variety of risks. Here, we're even a step further. We're into umbrella coverage, which is supposed to be even more expansive, and it's supposed to protect the policyholder in catastrophic situations. And believe me, this was one of those catastrophic situations. You want to be protected. So you've got, again, an extension of even further protection for unanticipated risks. The carriers talk that somehow they're going to be subjected to some endless chain of kinds of claims. Well, the original Knoll decision was decided many years ago. The carriers have taken absolutely no steps to change the policies. And what I would draw to the court's attention, look what happened after 9/11. Virtually overnight, the insurance industry issued exclusions on terror risk on all policies. It was so pervasive in that instance, because they were concerned about it, that you actually had federal legislation, TRIA, pass to try to deal with the insurance crisis that existed, because there they viewed there a risk that they could not calculate. Whenever they have that asbestos, absolute creation of the absolute asbestos exclusion. When insurers fear that there's some kind of risk that they're facing that they really aren't underwriting for, they take steps because they control the policy. They take steps to address it. That hasn't happened here. Separately, with respect to the not taking a step further, the language in their policies that they use is arising out of. And there are numerous. We cite a number of them in our brief, and there are cases beyond that from the Illinois courts that say arising out of is but for causation. It's a vague, broad term. It's supposed to be construed expansively. It is not proximate causation. It's but for causation. And in this case, if you go and you look at what the plaintiffs were alleging, they were alleging expressly that Boots' predecessor, Boots, disparaged the goods, services, and business of other drug manufacturers, advertised their own pharmaceuticals as more effective, more therapeutically effective. The flip side being is that the other manufacturers had inferior, less effective products, and the plaintiffs were alleging that that was not true. They were saying that those advertisements did not correctly reflect the Dong study, although that was subject to intense back and forth between the sides. Of course, they alleged that Dong was defamed, that she was accused of having bias in her study, that she was disparaged before the FDA, saying her work was worthless. I mean, there's just a series of allegations in the pleadings that both other pharmaceutical manufacturers were disparaged, that Dong and her study were defamed and disparaged, and as a result, again, but for causation, as a result, the plaintiffs chose Synthroid over other pharmaceuticals that were, they believe, alleging, therapeutically as good and less expensive, and that was the cause of their damages. I think it's also important to take a look at the Illinois Consumer Fraud Statute as well as the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. This is on page 20 of our brief. And that was the area where the plaintiffs were seeking. Of course, you don't have to have intent under the Consumer Fraud Statute in order to have a viable claim. And there the provision provides that you can have a DTPA suit against anyone disparaging the goods, services, or businesses of another by false or misleading statements. It goes on to add that a plaintiff need not prove competition. So you do not need a competitor in the case in order to have a claim under the DTPA, and you do not have to be the target of the disparaging remarks. That also was cited by Judge Castillo in the original Null case. That's in the statute itself. So if you analogize, again, from the Valley Forge Swiderski case, where you're looking at invasion of privacy, and you're looking here at the disparagement that's also available under our consumer statute, it's very hand-in-hand in terms of the duty to defend being invoked by the alleged wrongful conduct. I want to address a couple of the remarks that were made. The reason, once you get past the fact that you do have an allegation there's a duty to defend, these umbrella insurers provide this catastrophic protection. What you have in their policies is the primaries being exhausted by payment. It doesn't say whose payment. We cited cases in our brief that show that there are policies that are drafted that are specific, they control the traffic, that are specific to the primary insurer making the payment. That's not the language here. And other courts, including the Fourth Circuit, number of courts have decided when you have that open-ended language exhausted by payment, that payment can be made to others and by others. And that's the basis here that BASF put up the money for the settlements. Once that took place, and once you're looking at a catastrophic situation here with an umbrella policy, that their defense obligation is invoked. And it's a little bit interesting because they give you a defense obligation. So how is this ever supposed to be invoked? They're supposed to provide you a catastrophic protection. But in small cases, as they say, small cases, you're never going to get past that primary policy. And most cases, when you have a large amount, by the time that case gets resolved, you're already going to be into their lair, and you're not going to have a defense obligation. So when is it, in their view, that you're ever going to have a defense obligation under these umbrella policies? The answer is, when you look at the case law, it's once you see that there's an exposure that is going to exceed the amount of the primary policies, and once you have a payment, whether it's by the policyholder or the primaries that exceed the amount of those primary limits, the excess umbrella insurer's defense obligation is implicated. That's number one. That's the exhaustion element of it. Number two here, there are two Westchester policies that, separate from this excess function, provided that they would defend where the primary does not, as warranted. We cited to you the Tenth Circuit decision that says that as warranted has to have a meaning. Those words can't be there merely as surplusage. And the meaning is when the primaries do not defend as promised. And here the primaries were adjudicated to defend. They did not defend as promised. And at that point, Westchester needed to defend. Now, of course, all that you need to demonstrate is the potential for coverage or in order to get a duty to defend. That existed here, and at no time did Westchester defend. And all the policies except for Great American also extend, and this is part of this umbrella protection, a duty to defend claims. The primaries only have an obligation to defend suits. So we discussed this. In the initial consumer complaints, those were suits. At a point, there was a preliminary settlement. The settlement, at the time of the settlement, the third-party payers moved to intervene. They didn't file separate suits. They intervened, and they came and they told the court, we have claims. Whatever happens with this settlement, we want our claims taken out of it, or if our claims are going to be resolved as part of the settlement, then we have to come into this suit, we have to bring our own suit, and we have to have our claims heard. Those claims were there. And those claims, in essence, were there for 6 months before suits were actually filed. And during the 6 months, those claims of the third-party payers had to be researched. They had to be defended. Large sums of monies were expended pursuing and deciding what to do about the third-party payers and their claims before the suits actually came to pass. And there was no defense from the umbrella insurers. And there's certainly, in terms of the suits themselves, it's not mutually exclusive that the primaries and the umbrellas couldn't have mutual, at the same time, duties to defend. The umbrella insurers had the obligation to defend the claims, but you had also pending consumer suits, and you still had to do work, and the primary still had an obligation in terms of defense costs to assess what that intervention may or may not mean for the pending suits. So they both had duties to defend at that point in time. Talk a little bit about this estoppel rule. The Wausau case says there's only the one exception to once you have a breach to estoppel, and that's in certain conflict situations. That's not been raised here. It specifically used the notice issue as if you have a breacher stopped from trying to raise notice. And, in fact, it's virtually nonsensical if you listen to the allocation argument of the carriers. If you have a breach, if you're stopped to deny coverage, that means you're not able to raise points to argue and fight over coverage. But what they're saying now is, to some extent, okay, maybe we can't deny coverage, but maybe we can allocate it away. We can't deny it completely, but maybe we can nearly completely allocate it away by saying all these other areas are non-covered. Well, that certainly is not the same as saying you're precluded from denying coverage if you're able to, in essence, allocate by saying certain things aren't covered. That would completely undermine the principle of the estoppel as articulated by the Illinois Supreme Court. The notice issue. I think it's interesting to raise a couple things. One is they would be estopped because of the breach. But separately, the insurers never denied based on notice. They issued denials. They didn't raise notice as one of them. So in essence, this is a mend-to-hold kind of an argument. It's after the fact. They didn't step forward. They didn't say we're going to defend you. They didn't say we're going to do it under reservation of rights. They didn't file a declaratory judgment action, issue denial letters, and they don't raise notice as one of their issues. The other thing that they don't talk about, and I think it's clear from the history of this case, is the policies at issues were a predecessor company. It wasn't BASF. They were Boots policies. Those policies had to be tracked down through brokers before notice could be given. It was given to the primary insurers. This court's Seventh Circuit decision, authored by Judge Easterbrook, spoke about the flood of the suits starting in April of 1997. And that was because of the publication of Dong's article or study in JAMA. And with it came an editorial called the Synthroid Storm. And it was on the heels of that particular article that the mass flux of suits took place. Prior to that point in time, Mr. Allman, who was the general counsel, believed that he was going to be able to resolve this within the primary limits. After that point in time, he became of the view, it's in his testimony, that he was going to, this was not going to be resolved within primary limits, and followed up with notices to the umbrella insurer. So there isn't an obligation to notify the umbrella insurers until you have some sense that they're going to be implicated, and that's the point in time when he believed that they were going to be implicated and he gave them notice. He also invited all of them to a meeting, they don't talk too much about this, at the headquarters in New Jersey of BASF, and no one attended except for a representative of Great American. All the other insurers didn't bother to attend, and no one stepped forward, no one agreed to defend, and no one filed a timely declaratory judgment action. I got a couple other points raised by Platinum. I think it's interesting that in an attempt to allocate, the carriers raised the Platinum decision. One of the issues in Platinum, and it was set forth in the decision, is when you're looking at the settlement, it needs to be a release of liability. Every settlement here involved a release of liability. What was allowed to be challenged in the Platinum decision was, prior to the settlement, they were negotiating over the purchase of a trademark. There was a valuation of that trademark at something approaching $4 million. That was then built into the settlement. And what this court said was, you're going to be able to challenge the acquisition of an asset in the settlement. To the extent you're not having a release of liability, that can be challenged. But where you have a release of liability, as in this case, Platinum does not stand for the proposition that the carriers can allocate away and thus undermine the estoppel principle. As masters of their policies, too, I think it's important to note, and we did in our brief, that in other contexts where the carriers believe that they are going to face customer claims, they do draft provisions that address customers. And we have Federal Insurance Company here. We provided from the Illinois Department of Insurance the Chubb form, that's the parent group of Federal Insurance Company, in the context of financial institutions, when they think they're going to have customer claims, they have accepted from the advertising injury and personal injury coverage claims that are suffered, alleged, or alleged by customers. Well, if they wanted to make a limitation, because they are the masters of their own policies, in with respect to policies in other areas, other industries, whether it's the pharmaceutical industry or any other, they know how to draft policies to address those kinds of issues. And this court raised that very point in the Pipefitters case. And it's also interesting that the carriers say, well, you can't have coverage for economic harm, and here we have a business, and they're trying to draw fine distinctions. Those very points were made in the Pipefitters case that, yes, under the personal injury provision, you can have coverage for economic harm and for a business.
Was your settlement satisfaction in full for all everything, the settlement you entered into in the Knoll case?
In the Knoll primary case, no, it was not, Your Honor. We had settlements with primary carriers. We had a settlement that, in essence, concluded the judgment we had against those individual carriers. But it wasn't in full for everything. And, in fact, with respect to defense costs, because it was an arrangement that was worked out with the primary carriers and it's what Judge Castillo ordered, he actually allocated some of the defense costs among the different carriers. And you also had, prior to the judgment, you had a settlement with Royal Insurance Company. So there was an amount allocated to Royal Insurance Company. But I think the very point that the carriers are trying to raise is very disturbing on a number of levels. Number one, the point of that kind of rule that they're raising is to avoid double recovery. In no instance is BASF or anyone recovering anything twice. All they're looking for, all that's been asked, and all that the jury awarded were those defense costs that were not recovered from the primary insurers. Secondly,
they paid out their
primary limits, and then they paid out a portion. The total settlement, there was originally at one point a $50 million judgment, but the total settlement was $24.5 million, $12 million toward the primary limits and $12.5 million toward defense costs. And so what wasn't recovered in that $12.5 million of defense costs was also awarded by the jury in this case against the umbrella insurer. So there was no risk of double recovery, and that concern is what you see in the case law did not exist in this case. Double check a couple of the points, Your Honor. On the prior publication exclusion, there is obviously, if there's a breach in estoppel, you never get to that exclusion because you never get to the point of insurers attempting to argue exclusion to prevent coverage. But aside from that, if you look at the decisions from this court to Taco Bell and other courts throughout the country, it's a republication issue. That is, if you have an advertisement and you, in essence, republish the very same advertisement, the exclusion has potential applicability. But you're talking about identical or virtually identical statements or advertisements. Here, you can look at the complaint. Different studies, different critiques, different advertisements, all of which are alleged during the time period when their policies were in place, triggered their obligations. They dealt with, you know, the therapeutic effectiveness of Synthroid vis-a-vis other products. They dealt with Dong in different time periods with respect to her study. Different scientific journals, there was a debate and criticism of what was happening. There were talks where the Knoll people allegedly went BASF now. We're just compressing it to BASF for purpose of the argument. Went to the FDA and supposedly disparaged Dong and her study to the FDA. This is not one given advertisement or one statement or TV commercial that's republished over and over again over an extended period of time and therefore only is tied to the very first period. These are different statements, different disparaging statements, different allegedly defamatory statements, throughout the time period of the different policies, different statements, triggering each and every one of the policies. I very briefly just wanted to touch on one other point, which is the prejudgment interest. And that is when the jury awarded the recovery for the settlement, it in essence provided the entire amount of the insurer's policy limits. There's a set amount. So it's a very straightforward routine. As you know, Illinois, by statute, applicable to insurance policies, allows statutory 5% interest. Straightforward interest calculation. There also was an interest calculation on the defense invoices that ran from the time of the payment of the defense invoices. And there's a whole running of this information that was attached and provided to the trial court, Judge Derriagan, by the damages expert. There were certain offsets for defense costs that were incurred before notice was given to the carrier. So that was taken out. There were certain invoices. There was an issue. Those were taken out. But it was a very straightforward calculation. And the carriers have not cited anything in the calculation that was done that was wrong. There's nothing from the evidentiary record that was before Judge Derriagan that shows that he abuses discretion. And, in fact, the whole purpose of the statute is to compensate people who are out of money for the time value of money. And these carriers left no and BASF hanging there for a very long period of time. And as we find ourselves here today, we're still outside of that money to this very day. All that we have is what we were able to resolve, that small portion with the primary insurers. And unless there are any further questions, I think that wraps it up for me.
Thank you, Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Honor.
Ms. Kollross, to begin with, let me ask what is, I think, a fundamental question, but one that continues to bother me.
Certainly.
These policies must have covered something other than straightforward defamation. That arising out of language has to mean something. What did it mean?
It meant that the injury suffered by the plaintiffs bringing the claim against the insured must arise out of one of those offenses. So, for example, if the Synthroid plaintiffs had been defamed and they had a claim for something arising out of that defamation that they were asserting the defamation injury to themselves, that would be covered. That's really the point of all the...
What? What kind of injury?
Well, assume that they had suffered some sort of economic injury from the defamation. Say they were a manufacturer of products, they were defamed, they suffered a loss of business arising out of that defamation, then their monetary losses would be covered. That's the point really made in all of the cases which BASF has failed to address that discuss, analyze at length this exact arising out of standard policy language, and they say, no, it must be the plaintiffs who have suffered the defamation or the disparagement in order to qualify for advertising or personal injury coverage under this policy language. And there's been no discussion here this morning of any of those cases. No mention by BASF of why RISO is not correct. RISO actually was decided, a member on that panel was Judge Shader from our own Northern District, who said that the Knoll decision went too far in charting new territory, that where school districts are alleging antitrust claims based upon alleged disparagement of other people, those claims do not arise out of that defamation because the injuries suffered are economic injuries caused by the higher prices. It's not the defamation. There is no reputational injury. That's the same language, the same type of claims asserted in an antitrust action in Purdue Frederick. Again, the court says, no, these injuries do not arise out of reputational damage to third parties, but the overpayment. These plaintiffs paid too much for the products, and therefore this does not qualify as an advertising or personal injury. QSP, the very same analysis, the same arising out of language, same conclusion. The Diamond States case from Illinois, not bodily injury, where the state of Illinois was only alleging their economic losses that had bodily injury to their employees as a background factor, but they had not paid out for those injuries. It was not a subrogation situation where the state of Illinois was saying, I paid X number of hours of sick time, now I want you, the insured, to repay me for that. That might have qualified as bodily injury under the policy, but it didn't. And we don't have a claim like that here. The Synthroid plaintiffs are not asserting that somehow they paid for a reputational injury. On the contrary, they're saying we paid too much money because we were overcharged. I do want to address BASF's point regarding the need for a reservation of rights or declaratory judgment that would have been true if we were primary carriers with a primary duty to defend. We weren't. Illinois law clearly provides that an excess carrier without a duty to defend need not issue a reservation of rights, need not file a declaratory judgment action in order to preserve its position that coverage does not exist. And I ask this court to consider, if BASF's theory is correct, that their payment in October 1997 ended the primary carrier's defense obligation, why did they claim in the primary carrier action that the primary carriers owed over $30 million in defense costs, which were incurred by BASF after that settlement took place? Not only did they allege it, they got a judgment for all of those expenses, all of those defense costs. That is irreconcilable with the position that they are now bringing in front of this court, that really the defense obligation of the primary carriers ended back in October 1997. The Valley Forge case that was mentioned repeatedly in BASF's argument was a consumer fraud action, but the plaintiffs in that case suffered the injury. It was their privacy that was violated, giving rise to those statutory claims. Here, it was not the Synthroid plaintiffs who were defamed or disparaged, so Valley Forge provides no assistance to BASF on their claim. Again, the cases are clear. This issue has been addressed and resolved unanimously in Illinois and beyond. There is no coverage here. And just as a final response, as far as BASF's assertion that it was really the April 1997 article that began the floodgate of Synthroid claims, that's incorrect. Multiple lawsuits were filed before then. Millions of dollars of defense costs had been incurred, and they were discussing a nine-figure settlement. That's $100 million plus. Primaries ended at $12 million. Clearly, they knew that the excess policies were at least potentially implicated. They waited 14 months to give notice. That's late notice, and it bars coverage under these policies. Thank you, Your Honor.